So for those who haven't been on this retreat before, the Lungpa Pasano has shifted the responsibility of the afternoon reflections to some of the rest of us here, at least for a few days, next 6 days or so for the afternoons. It's always a little difficult to know what to offer in terms of a reflection, something that would be useful for a wide variety of people, but also something that's reflective of something that's useful, that I found useful in my practice. It's always a bit of a challenge to try and make it relevant to everybody, including oneself. So if it's not relevant, you can just kind of drift off, fall asleep. But I was when I was thinking about what to talk about, my mind was kind of going in a number of different directions. But kind of wanted to settle in to some sort of the long-term aspects of practice, practicing over a long period of time. A lot of people here have been practicing for a long time, many years. So my mind was kind of moving in that direction as well. And amongst a number of different thoughts that came up, all of a sudden I was reminded of kind of a series of little events right at the beginning of my monastic training, when I was still in Anagarika. I think it was in the summer of 97, so it would have been the final couple of months of my first year as an Anagarika at the monastery. And we had instead of the first Tuesday in Berkeley group, there was I don't know if it might have been even Tuesday night, but one night a month where we would go into San Francisco and have that same kind of venue offering some teachings. And Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano were due to be down there one evening. And then we were due to drive down to L.A. that very night to go to some teachings from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He was giving those at UCLA, a weekend of teachings. And so I was, still being an Anagarika, I was doing the driving. And we ended up deciding to travel during the night after the talk in San Francisco. So got into the car probably around 10 or 11 to drive through the night down to L.A. To attend the teachings, which started the next morning. And Ajahn Pasano was sitting next to me, of course. This was in a teeny little Honda at the time. And Ajahn Amaro was sitting in the back seat. And to kind of help get through the evening, trying to help keep me awake on the road, in addition to lots of cheap coffee, there wasn't a lot of Starbucks or anything. We had borrowed this tape from Mark Lieberman, a good friend of ours, and it was a tape done by a fellow named Terence McKenna. I don't know if anybody knows the name. And I didn't really know him, but got to know him a little bit during that night. He was a contemporary, I guess. People can correct me if I'm wrong, but a contemporary along the same lines of Timothy Leary and a few of the seers of that time, the experimenters of that time. And his basically, to make a very, very long story, very, very short, it was a series of audio tapes that basically explored his exploration of trying to find a vehicle for expansion of his consciousness, and kind of woven in with a lot of experimentation, interest of trying to find some relevant metaphysical theory to explain the consciousness of the universe, and tie it in with his own kind of way of seeking something. I'm not sure quite what he was seeking. I'm not sure he knew quite what he was seeking, but a sense of form of expanded consciousness. And so it ended up being this very, very, very long story of trips to the Amazon and the search for the discovery of this kind of fungus that somehow was the key to the world and the universe and expansion of consciousness. So this was all going along as I was driving down I-5 to L.A., trying to stay awake. And I couldn't tell you exactly where it all went, except that it didn't really help me from my own hallucinations on the road. Somehow we made it safely. But it also is just sort of like kind of a metaphor, I think, for kind of, you know, what it is that it was kind of an attempt at that time in that era of looking for some sort of freedom from some sort of and trying to find some sort of transcendent understanding of the world, the universe, the realm of human consciousness. Is there a way to find some sort of different way of viewing the world, seeing the world than the traditional orientation of society, particularly at that time. And so there was, most everybody here knows, there was a lot of experimentation and a lot of trying to do this through various means, mostly with drugs. I think that a lot of people in this room, you know, were maybe at least on the periphery. I was mostly on the periphery of this. I never really jumped full on into it, for which I'm grateful. there was always passing interest watching from the sidelines of all this was going on. I was also just a little bit behind that generation, just a few years. So I didn't quite get pulled into it as much as others. And so I was able to get through it with some of my brain cells left. But I think that, one result of that for a number of people was, you know, the realization that this search for happiness, this search for freedom, peace, isn't something that can really be answered through even mind-expanding drugs or any kind of things that are, related to that kind of sensual experience, even with a lofty goal in mind. And a lot of those people found themselves turning more towards meditation, developing inner qualities, exploring that whole path in a more what's considered more traditionally spiritual way. And then, of course, all the people who stumbled across meditation practice in Southeast Asia, Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and started to bring it back to the West. And it's interesting because what has evolved is, in the West anyway, is kind of what it is that we're experiencing right here now, this kind of retreat culture. So that the search for a bit of truth, inner peace, has taken this form of learning how to practice meditation in this kind of a setting, in a retreat atmosphere. And it's done a lot of good. It's brought a lot of people to focus. A lot of good teaching and learning has taken place in this kind of environment. It's a time when people can set aside the concerns of the daily life, take some time off of work, of obligations, and come and immerse ourselves in learning a bit about the practice and really delving in and digging in for a period of 8, 9, 10 days to help really help make it gel in our experience, in our practice. So it's a very good thing, and it certainly is a lot more skillful, I think, than, you know, popping some LSD. but sometimes I wonder, in fact, I'm fairly sure I have a good sense that it's not a sufficient kind of venue for really a long-term kind of living of one's life towards attaining the freedom that the Buddha has taught us is possible. And I certainly have found for myself over many years of being interested in the practice, both as a layman and then taking ordination and being at the monastery since that time, that the long-term perspective is really important, because as probably many of us who have been practicing for many years and going to many, many retreats have realized, that it's not quite as sudden and immediate and simple as one might have initially thought or one would have hoped. And in fact, that very conference that I was driving down to that night, one of the most memorable things I heard at that time and have ever heard was from His Holiness, and you've probably, I think maybe even Ajahn Pasano, mentioned this in one of the past retreats, this particular teaching from His Holiness, but I'll mention it again because it was so powerful. And it was in that stadium at UCLA where he was talking about some of the teachings of Nagarjuna, but there was a period of questions and answers. I can't remember, it might have been the second day of the teachings. This was a very, very full stadium, inside stadium, with many, many thousands of people. And it was a question and answer period. And somebody asked the question to His Holiness of, it's good to hear what you're teaching, but is there another way that is, you know, you've been teaching kind of this long-term gradual approach. Is there another way that's that we can learn about that's quicker and easier and will get us faster, you know, to enlightenment? And it was a legitimate enough question, I guess. But at that point, His Holiness kind of just went very, very quiet. And there was a very, very long pause, as you could see, you know, his mind working, and the whole stadium was so silent. You could, you know, you really literally could have heard a pin drop as people were waiting for his response. And it wasn't too long that after that you could actually see some tears coming down his face. When he spoke, it was like the quintessential lion's roar that you hear about in the teachings. It was, he just boomed out with, "There is no quick, there is no easy. If I knew of another way that was quicker and easier than what I'm teaching, don't you think I would tell you how to do it?" And that was the answer. So there is no quick, there is no easy. This is a long-term practice. So I just bring that up because that's something that has helped me, that just hearing that resonate in my mind over the years has been extraordinarily helpful whenever I find myself feeling frustrated or getting impatient or seeing old habits come back for the umpteenth time and getting caught again in different mind states. Hearing that resonant voice of there is no quick, there is no easy, this is long-term practice. It helps keep me going. So in addition to periods like this where we can really commit ourselves to settling down, developing some skills, tools of meditation, I think it's also a useful time to really reflect on how this is really just part of a continuum. In a way, it's special, and we really need to take advantage of this opportunity and put forth a lot of effort. Time is precious. Life is short. And these opportunities are rare. So we need to make the best use of them we can. And at the same time, you really need to have that kind of attitude through your whole life, not just this 10 days. Our whole life is precious. This opportunity is rare. Time is passing quickly. So even though this is a particularly important 10 days in most people's year, it shouldn't be compartmentalized. It shouldn't be isolated. In terms of realizing what it is that we really need to do and where we want to spend our time and how we want to live our lives. It's part of that flow. It's a kind of a deep part of a cycle. But the rest of that that time is so important too. And it really helps to keep in perspective the fact that as important a part of the practice towards finding real freedom, meditation practice is, it's not the only part. There's a lot of other aspects of the path, of the practice, of the training that needs to be developed and cultivated off the cushion, or even sometimes on the cushion. It's a very comprehensive training that we need to go through and commit ourselves to. Again, meditation is a very significant and important part of it, but it's only a part of it. And I think that what one finds over a long period of time, and certainly what I find in my experience is that it's very gradual, imperceptible. Shifting that takes place over many years of commitment to a full path, and sometimes it's really not something that's easily noticeable. It's a kind of a process that is operating in the background all the time. If you have committed yourself to a certain way of life and a certain goal in life, and it's a way of structuring your life, structuring your behaviors and attitudes that over time becomes not so fully conscious. It just becomes part of how one lives. And it's still operating and still processing throughout our daily lives and still gradually molding the heart and gradually molding the mind in ways that sometimes we don't really see until we really look and carefully reflect and over a period of time. It's the one drop at a time into the vessel experience where you don't really notice it until you look sometime later and reflect, is there a difference between now and 5 years ago or 10 years ago in the quality of my experience? So it's important to realize that the practice, if you're sincere and if you really take it to heart, that the practice does bear fruit in ways that maybe aren't always so obvious, and that sometimes the discouragement of feeling like all these years, you know, where, what do I have to show for all these years of effort? That sometimes it's not so readily apparent on the surface, and taking time to be on retreat like this can be an opportunity to actually to go back and reflect and examine over time, review your life since you started practicing, and to really look back and see if you can see some differences in your heart, in your mind, from the years of effort that you've put in. So there's a lot of long-term qualities that we need to cultivate to help support us in the foundations, the fundamentals of the practice. And you know, there's a lot of different kind of teachings around that. Lungpa was talking about working with the hindrances this morning, so having frameworks like that to view one's experience, not just in terms of meditation, but in terms of how they affect our life, learning how to denourish them and to nourish other qualities that we want to keep, is important to do. And the Buddha, you know, has many different kind of structures to do that. As again, when Paul was talking this morning, the hindrances and the factors of enlightenment. Also, things like the 10 paramitas, the perfections that we need to develop as supports for our practice. These are all qualities that we need to spend our effort in either relinquishing the unskillful ones or developing and maintaining the skillful ones over long periods of time. And it's these kinds of qualities that are deeply embedded in the citta, in the heart, that for better or for worse is what we take with us when the time comes for us to move on at the end of our lives, for instance. These are things that are long-lasting impressions in the mind and carry over. You know, assuming that most of us here are probably not going to finish our work in this lifetime, it's really good to have a very long-term perspective to help carry us through the transitions. You know, I kind of hesitate a little bit to bring this up because I know not everybody kind of feels comfortable with the idea of future lives, rebirth, those kinds of things. But even if you don't, even if you can't get your mind around accepting it on faith and accepting that teaching on faith, and it's very much of an integral part of the Buddha's teaching, that there are many opportunities to do this. We all have been traveling through samsara for indeterminable amount of time, and will continue to do so according to the teachings. But even if you don't really believe that or accept that on faith, if you take it as a working hypothesis, as a possibility, then it really helps to develop that kind of long-term viewpoint. So I'd suggest that it's a skillful reflection to hold on to, even if it's not something that you want to take lock, stock, and barrel. But to realize that the development of this practice is a long-term, over many lifetime experience, and that we want to maximize what we take with us in terms of skillful qualities to help condition the next round for ourselves, as well as providing an incredible amount of peace and clarity and freedom in this very lifetime. One of the qualities that I have found very useful in trying to develop and reflect on again and again is the quality of truthfulness. One of the paramitas, one of the 10 perfections, satya. And I've just found that reflecting on that and working with that over the years has been a very grounding, stabilizing force in my practice and in my life, because it helps keep me moving in the right direction. There's a lot of different ways, I think, that practicing with truthfulness can be done. It has a lot of different facets to it. One of the monks at Abhayagiri was giving a morning reflection the other day along those themes, and just the importance of taking refuge in truthfulness is a way to really ground oneself and help free oneself. And it was a very lovely reflection, and I've been thinking about that some. And was reflecting that, like at its very basic level, taking refuge and committing oneself to truth, it's often, you know, we see that right at the very beginning in terms of the precepts, in terms of speech, practicing speech that is truthful is sort of our ground practice for practicing truth. Because our speech is a way where we can really express many of the different kinds of obstructions in our mind, defilements in our mind, it can be a real mirror for us if we're able to use it as a kind of a container for that experience. So we make a resolution, we make an affirmation to not tell lies. That's one of the basic precepts. And that provides a container for us to see how it is that our mind moves sometimes. And I think most of us here, probably all of us here, have, you know, a pretty strong commitment to and pretty good experience with being quite careful around telling deliberate lies. You know, we've all worked in the practice enough that we've seen the effects in our lives when we tell a deliberate lie for some reason or another. Sometimes they're very selfish reasons, dealing with self-interest. Sometimes they're more couched in some sort of altruistic intention. But we see the resonance in our hearts and the resonance in our minds when we cross that boundary, and we see the pain that it causes in our lives when we do that. And I think you know, most of us have taken that precept to heart and really follow that to the best of our abilities. But it's also interesting to see how it can really happen on subtle levels, and this is where it's really useful. Way as a mind training, one of these long-term mind trainings that can really give us some insight into how it is that we can continue to cause ripples in the mind that lead to suffering. And I just remember a time early on in my monastic life where I was noticing just this tendency to be prone to exaggeration. A lot of times it was out of trying to, you know, make a point or make myself heard, fear that I wasn't going to be taken seriously. Any numbers of kinds of subtle motivations where I find myself just exaggerating things a bit, you know, being frustrated, say, with somebody and telling somebody else about it and kind of, you know, saying, they're always like this, or they do this all the time, or this is the 100th time this has happened, you know. And, you know, then catching myself and thinking, well, maybe they don't always do that. Or maybe it was only the 10th time, not the 100th time. But finding just different subtle ways that the mind would take to exaggerate, to distort the truth, maybe sometimes to tell a good story or to make a point or to catch somebody's attention. But there was always be this little bit of dissonance that would be left over, and I'd find myself feeling regretful, even though it wasn't always a conscious kind of activity. There was this feeling of, oh, well, did I really need to say that? Was that really, that really wasn't quite true. It maybe was also at the expense of somebody else that there was this exaggeration. So regret would come up. And I found myself doing that enough that I decided that even, you know, as most people know, in our practice as monastics, we have to do confession every couple of weeks for any transgression against the Padimokkha rules. And one of them is, you know, one of the rules is not to engage in telling a deliberate lie. So even though this didn't fit the criteria, this particular habit didn't fit the criteria of telling a deliberate lie, it was disturbing enough to me that I decided to make a practice for a time of when I did that, when I found myself doing that, to confess it to another monk, even though it wasn't an official violation of the rules. I just wanted to make it really conscious to do that. And it was a very useful tool, because I found that the pain of week after week of having to say the same thing over and over again to somebody while I did it again was enough to bring up a sense of conscience, to really start to watch that tendency very carefully. And basically just to help soothe the mind and bring it to a greater sense of a refinement. Because as one goes along in the practice and you do these kinds of practices, you see over time how much more sensitive the mind gets to the little obstructions that are currently or are constantly going on as an undercurrent, and as the grosser obstructions, grosser defilements start to fade away, the mind becomes much more sensitive to the little ones, and so tuning into the finer distinctions is something that becomes part of the practice. And it's, again, it's part of this long-term practice. This isn't something that you basically develop just by doing a, you know, half an hour of meditation in the morning, half an hour of meditation in the evening. This is part of a greater part of this whole practice, greater part of this whole path than just the meditation on the cushion. I find that the reflection on truthfulness also comes out in other ways, not just in the stories we tell ourselves or the machinations of the mind, the internal ways we have of trying to justify ourselves, trying to keep honest about that, but also truthfulness in looking at our experience, what the truth is of our reality, of our moment-to-moment experience, and a commitment to authenticity, a commitment to integrity, just as we examine what's going on in our own mind, is a very powerful tool. Because the mind is so slippery. I mean, most of the time we operate under the influence of these old habits that are really trying to wriggle our way out of certain realizations or experiences because we don't want to see them. And we come up with all sorts of mind activities as a way of dodging what is the truth of our experience sometimes. When we're confronted with difficult circumstances or very challenging ones, both either in terms of very unpleasant mind states, which we all experience from time to time, mind states like anger, frustration, depression, grief. The mind is built with so many different kinds of ways of trying to avoid the painfulness of those experiences. Most of us are also, to some degree or another, subject to very strong pulls of sensual desire in one way or another. You know, there's all sorts of justifications that we can get ourselves into for trying to alleviate boredom or pain or suffering through pursuing distraction, pursuing sensual pleasure, not just, you know, in the normal course of things, but really trying to distract ourselves and soothe ourselves and find something pleasurable in what can sometimes be a boring or difficult or painful experience. And all the ways that we justify that by telling ourselves stories that aren't really completely true. You know, like, I really need to do this for myself. I'm taking care of myself. If I do this particular thing, if I don't look after myself, nobody else will. You know, all these kinds of stories that we've kind of developed and planted in our minds over many years of conditioning as a way of doing something to alleviate the painfulness, whether great or small, the painfulness of human existence. So really just establishing oneself in a commitment to truth and examining those states of mind, using the precepts to put a barrier around our actual outward action in body or speech, putting that barrier around and holding to that as best we can, just long enough to be able to say to ourselves, is this really true? Is what I'm telling myself, is what I'm feeling like I need to do, is that really true? Or is my mind just looking for another way of alleviating some sort of difficulty, some sort of suffering? Or is my anger as justified as I really think it is? You know, I think a lot of us, it's very easy to get involved in righteous indignation. You know, we think that there is some injustice, and it's not right, it's not the way it should be. And then we have an emotional reaction of anger or a sense of injustice, that kind of indignation, and we feel it's justified because of some set of circumstances external to us that don't seem right, that don't seem fair. So it's an opportunity to again ask ourselves, is that really true? Am I justified in feeling anger? Is there a justification? Maybe the circumstances are really kind of not fair in how we would see things, but does that justify this kind of reaction? Does it lead to peace? Or does it just lead to more suffering? So we're being willing to take the time to ask ourselves, you know, is that really true? Is my assumption about this situation really true? Am I really willing to look at it rather than just react to it? It's a way of practicing that truthfulness, that commitment to authenticity, to take the time and to ask ourselves that question. I remember even, actually, many years ago, even before I took my ordination, it was on a retreat here at the Angelus Center, actually, I think with Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Amaro. And I remember making that my practice as I was particularly as I just had this vision of my doing walking meditation out behind the Angela Center there one day, and repetitively finding myself overwhelmed with feelings of not wanting to be there, feelings of frustration, feelings of restlessness, almost crawling out of my skin, and also telling myself the usual stories I think that a beginning practitioner does of, it's not supposed to be this way, I shouldn't feel like this, this is supposed to be peaceful, everybody else seems to be, peaceful, they're also quiet and they look also serene, and I'm just this, crawling inside of my skin, I just want to jump in my car and leave, kind of a feeling. And I don't know whether it was probably some reflection that Ajahn Sumedho or Ajahn Amaro had, and I was working with it, but it was basically just repeating the question to myself, what's the truth here? And oftentimes it would come up with, the truth is, I can't stand this any longer. The truth is, I really don't want to be here. The truth is, I want to get out as soon as I can. The truth is, I've also made a commitment to stay and not to run away from this. And just by examining that and, letting it be known for what it is, letting the mind state be known for what it is, recognizing it, acknowledging it, validating it, whether it was pleasant or unpleasant or right or wrong, just that acknowledgement of saying, as Ajahn Sumedho would say, this is the way it is. But posing that question, what is the truth? What is the truth of this situation? What is real right now, whether it's good or bad or according to my desires or not? What is the truth? And it's amazing how the mind can just relax, even in the most unpleasant of circumstances. The resistance will lessen and will decrease with that acknowledgement of truth. So that's just one of these kind of long-term states of mind or qualities of mind that one needs to develop in this practice. But one in particular that I've found over the years very, very beneficial, this commitment to truthfulness. And it's this kind of thing, it's this kind of practice that is slowly over many years developing in the background, operating in the background, and slowly transforming the heart in very, very subtle ways, ways that we don't always see. But the constant and relentless commitment to developing all of these ways of training the heart and training the mind that over a very long period of time really actually do make a difference, even if we're not consciously aware of it. I was telling people this past summer that that was actually something that I was experiencing very deeply on a two-week meditation retreat that we each take during the summer at the monastery, I had just come off of a very busy time in the monastery with a lot of activities, a lot of engagement, a lot of work tasks, and at least the first several days of my solitary retreat, the mind was just churning and churning and churning, even though I wasn't putting anything new into it. It was just the aftermath of a very busy time. And just going up and down my walking path, for long periods of time with this kind of mental activity going, but also realizing that kind of behind it, beneath it, was this sense of happiness that was almost completely unrelated to all the different things that were going through my mind. And a sense of ease, and a sense of, I was trying to come up with a way to describe it during that time, and what came up to my mind was just sort of this space of goodness, that was very clear and very poignant. And I started to really pay attention to it, even though the other things were kind of going on this very surface level. I realized that that's really just, that they were just very active on that level, and that there was a much deeper level, that this long-term practice had really started to make me understand and to bring forth in my own level of awareness. I started to just really enjoy turning my attention into that space of goodness, of really realizing that there are some fruits of practice over a 15, 20, 25 year period of time, that even if I, you know, haven't perfected my roadmap to fourth jhana or, you know, some of those really exalted states of experience, that there's been this kind of slow over period of time development of this kind of space of goodness inside that just comes through doing the practice day after day, week after week, month after month, and just maintaining that sense of commitment and steadiness as much as possible. That kind of effort over a period of time cannot help but have some results. And I just wanted to share that because I think probably there's a number of people in this room who are in the same kind of position, having practiced for many, many, many years. And sometimes it's hard to see the difference it really makes, even though there aren't maybe big bells and whistles going off all the time, and that, you know, the mind doesn't just really settle into extremely deep states of concentration on day three of a meditation retreat, and that the insights aren't coming left and right, blazing one into the path to enlightenment, that there is this goodness in the heart that you probably can tap into and probably can experience if you turn your attention in that direction. And so I think that I just like to encourage people to do that on this retreat, to start really reflecting on that. There's certain, you know, to really turn one's attention into looking at some of what some of the fruits of the experience are right now, making it conscious. These are things that are developing slowly over a period of time, and that these are things that you can take with you. These are long-term benefits, long-term aspects of this practice. And I think there are certain triggers that you can bring into reflection. This is where some of the reflections Lumpa was talking about the other day as well are very useful in turning one's attention towards that space in the mind that's slowly gaining momentum. And it's some of those recollections that can turn the attention in that direction, rather than keeping focused on the surface manifestations of restlessness or some of the hindrances that are there, to let those be there and to understand them, to see them with clarity and with truth, but to also take the time to turn the attention towards those reflections that will help one see this underlying spaciousness, this underlying goodness that's being developed over a long period of time. And sometimes it's just a simple reflection on something like the teachings of the Buddha, the practices of kindness and generosity that we've put into our lives, that we've cultivated over a long period of time, just the practice of following five precepts over a long period of time, actively reflecting on that and looking at the benefit, the amount that you've contributed towards the harmlessness in the world, the ways that you've contributed towards the well-being of not only yourself but of others, reflecting on that and reflecting that there are other people who are doing that too. And even just looking around the room and realizing that there are a lot of good people. Everybody in here has a very sincere wish for peace, for clarity, for understanding. And a lot of people have put in a lot of effort and time towards making that happen in their lives and in the lives of other people, and just reflecting on that and establishing a sense of appreciation, of gratitude for being able to be in a situation like this with a rare but growing number of people who can come together to share that common value and to support each other with that, and to just take delight in reflecting on that, you know, the path really does work, and that we're, you know, a living example of that happening right here and now. So just to take that time to really let that sink in, turn the mind towards that, and really let the mind settle with that. Really bring that up and let that color your mood. Let that really infuse your attention, your awareness, with that sense of gratitude, with that sense of appreciation, that sense of goodness that there is in this world, that it's possible, despite all that's going on in the world out there, that the potential for the development and sustaining of this space of goodness is everybody's potential, and it's actually probably really happening right here, even though it's not quite so apparent. So just take the time to tune into that, to sit with that, to dwell with it, and to drink it in. So I think I'll just leave it there for reflection.